Hey, Barrett Eagleston here, your celeb expert and your celeb savant. Celeb Savant is a weekly entertainment show. We have long-form career retrospective type interviews with celebrities, singers, actors, and industry experts. Up next on Celeb Savant, I'll be speaking to Mike Scott from The Waterboys. The Waterboys are a folk rock band formed in Edinburgh in 1983 by Scottish musician Mike Scott. The band's membership, past and present, has been composed mainly of musicians from Scotland, Ireland, Wales and England. Mike Scott has remained as the only constant member throughout the band's career. They've explored a number of different styles, but their music is mainly a mix of folk music with rock and roll. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Mike Scott from The Waterboys. Thank you for joining me, Celeb Savant, today. So where do we find you in the world? What's happening in your life and how are you doing?
I'm in Dublin, Ireland at home. Just returned from a family holiday to Japan. Mm-hmm. And like Billericay Dicky, I'm doing very well.
And how was Japan?
Hot.
Was it hot?
Very hot.
Let's take it all the way back to the beginning of your music career. I know it's many decades, so let's dive into the very beginning. What inspired you to start singing, being creative, creating music? Let's start at the very beginning.
Well, I started to fall in love with records, Barrett, when I was about 9 years old. You know, later on, I would get crushes on girls, but first I got crushes on records. Like my first love. And I decided then that what I really wanted to do was to live inside music and to make music. And a few years after that, one of my parents bought me a guitar, and then I taught myself to play, and I always had teenage bands, and really nothing ever replaced that. That was always what I wanted to do. It was always my number one interest.
Where does the name The Waterboys come from? Why that name?
It's in America. It's a well-known word because it means the boys who brought water to the chain gang or to the sports players. But it's not a word that's known in the British Isles, where I come from. And I encountered it on a Lou Reed album. The album was called Berlin. It's one of his best known albums. It was a great favorite of mine when I was a teenager. And there's one song where he sings, "I am the water boy." And I didn't know what a water boy was, but I liked the feel of the word. I liked the mystery of the word. So I picked it as my band name. And of course, soon after I started using it as my band name, people started saying, well, do you know what a water boy is? Why did you choose that? And so on. And then I discovered what it actually means.
Did it change your perception of the name once you discovered what it meant?
No, I didn't really care because, you know, a band name is a band name and its meaning changes as people associate it with the band. For example, you think of Led Zeppelin. Well, everybody thinks of the band when they hear that word. They don't necessarily think of a Zeppelin made of lead. They think of the band. When you think Beatles, people don't think what a bad pun it is. They just think of the Beatles.
I suppose so, yeah, that's correct. Let's dive into the creative mind of Mike. Tell us, what is the process of creating songs or music? Is it still the same today as it was then? How does the process of creating from nothing to a 3 to 4 minute song come about for you?
Well, it can come about in all different kinds of ways.
Okay.
Not an easy question to answer cold like that because it's such a wide topic and there are such a variety of ways, especially for an older artist like myself. Over my life in music, I've discovered so many different ways that a song can be sparked. A song can come out of a chord sequence. I might be playing guitar and a light upon a chord sequence that really turns me on. And I think, oh, it sounds like a song. Man, what words could go with this? Or it could come from a title.
Yes.
Like Full of the Moon, which was a title that became a song. Or it could come from a couplet, a rhyming couplet. Or it might be that I've got a concept and I want to write a song about a specific matter. And I write in all those ways. I suppose I had a more limited set of spurs to songwriting when I began, and over the years it's broadened.
Speaking of that song, The Hole of the Moon, I'm not sure if you read that article or heard about that person who had lost their memory.
And, yes.
And hearing that song sparked their memory to return.
Yeah.
How does that make you feel?
What does that mean to you?
Well, you know, it's not that big a deal, really, because obviously the song meant something significant to the chap, and I'm very, very glad it helped him recover his memory. But it could have been any other song, really. I don't think it necessarily means that my song's a particularly amazing song because of that or anything. But, of course, I'm touched that it meant so much to him that it sparked his memory.
Who inspires you? Some of your favorite artists that you listen to back in the 80s, 90s, and today, are they still the same artists, or are there any other artists that you have grown into, you know, that are new artists that have come out in the later decades?
Well, really, I started listening to music in the 1960s.
Yeah.
When I was a kid. And my favorite artists then were the Beatles and the pop artists of the day, soul music artists. And in fact, I didn't even think in terms of, apart from the Beatles, perhaps, I didn't think in terms of artists. I just thought in terms of songs or records. And I would have all my favorite records. Then when I reached about 11 or 12, I began to be a fan of particular artists like the Rolling Stones or Bob Dylan and so on. And I still like those artists. I don't really listen to Bob so much these days, but I still love the Rolling Stones and the Beatles very much. And I still love all the soul music that I listened to as a kid, all the Motown music. And still, for me, that's the gold standard, really. Marvin Gaye singing "I Heard It Through the Grapevine," nothing's ever beat that for me. But I still discover new artists, yes. And I just discovered a band called the KCBs from Germany, who I actually heard when I was in Japan. I was in a bookstore, and there was this great music playing, funky music with a fantastic female voice. And it was the KCBs with a girl singer whose name, confusingly, is Bowie, spelled like as in David Bowie.
Yes.
And this killer song. So I'm still open to hearing music anywhere and wherever.
And music was, as you mentioned, it was vinyl, cassettes, CDs. These days, it's these digital platforms that people are consuming music through and by. What are your perceptions of the way consumers are now listening to music compared to back when you were a child or when you first started releasing music?
Well, I probably don't have anything very interesting to say on this, because it's such a widely disseminated topic that almost everything that could be said about it has been said.
Yeah.
Many people before me have commented that in the late 50s and early 60s, when the first generations of rock musicians were coming up, it was very hard for them to access the music. They would have to buy a record on an import, or they might have to tune into an offshore radio station after dark with a torch under their bedclothes to find the right place. And it was very, very hard for them to find the music, and that increased the value of the music and the mystery of the music.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm reminded of people like Pete Townshend or John Lennon talking about how they would try to get the Radio Luxembourg single so they could hear the latest Little Richard single. And now, of course, it couldn't be more different, because everybody's got almost all the music that's ever been made at the press of a button. And in some ways, of course, that's a great thing. And in some ways, it takes away the mystery of music. And I don't really have anything to add to that, except it's just the way it is. And all through the history of music, people have dealt with the way it is. And there's nothing you can do about it, really.
I like what you said about it being a mystery, because these days the whole album's released that you can find all the information, whereas before it was like one single, and what would that single be? And then it would be another single, and a few weeks later the album release, and you don't know what would be on the album. And it takes the mystery and the excitement has been taken away a little bit from that experience. So the younger generations these days won't know that experience of that, oh, we're going to be hearing the first single on this time on the charts, or this time on the radio, and then the rest of the album will be a secret until you get it into your hands. So that whole mystery of finding everything out is, you're right, has been taken away. It's taken away that excitement, a little bit of excitement of the release of music, for me a bit.
Well, actually, I disagree.
Okay.
Because if Taylor Swift goes online and says, my new album's dropping on Friday, millions of Taylor Swift fans will be incredibly excited, especially on Friday morning when they can download the album. But it's just moved into a different form.
I suppose so, yeah. Easier to attain.
Yeah, definitely easier to obtain, yes.
Performing live, tell me about that. I understand you'll be coming to South Africa shortly.
I look forward to
seeing and hopefully meeting you in person. Tell us about your experience of performing live. What is that for you? And why does the stage keep calling you back each year?
Oh, well, I have always loved walking onto a stage. It's that experience of stepping out from the wings into the spotlight on the stage is one of the most exciting things in my life, and I never stop loving it.
What brings you that excitement? You know, what are the different elements for you?
Well, it's a combination of things, I suppose. I've got to say, I don't think about it. I don't unpack it. It's just something I enjoy. But if I had to think about it and say what are the elements that make up that excitement, part of it, of course, is the audience and the excitement of if the audience is excited themselves, of course, that creates a strong atmosphere. And part of it is the fact of actually standing on a stage and everyone's attention being on me, and it's also the pleasure and excitement and indeed privilege of playing music into the consciousness of the audience, of delivering something and also something that's unpredictable. I don't know exactly what form it's going to take when we start playing, and I don't know exactly how I'm going to sing the song. I'm not sure exactly how I'm going to play the guitar, and I'm not sure exactly what my band are going to do. There's a whole lot of discovery to happen on that stage, and I enjoy the act of delivering that or channeling that to the audience, and then getting the audience's feedback, and then using the audience's feedback to inspire me a little bit higher, and so on. And the whole experience is a very satisfying and exciting one. Of course, sometimes it goes wrong as well, and every artist knows you can have a bad gig or you can have an off night. But fortunately, in the Waterboys, we don't seem to have many of those, and I've always enjoyed our live work.
And I'm very much a person who likes to stand like right in the front at concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And what bothers me about the rest of the people is they've got their cell phones up trying to get perfect video, perfect photo, where you guys are right there, right in front of us. And I find it so distracting for myself seeing everyone with their cell phones trying to get those perfect elements of perfect videos. What are your thoughts these days of just so many people with their cell phones up compared to being in the present moment and just being there and enjoying the show?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? It's an interesting psychology behind it. The reason that they're putting the cell phones up is that they want to share it with other people who are not there. And they want to share it to show how cool they are, perhaps. Or maybe they just love the music and want to share the music. They've got their own motivations for doing it. And I don't have a big problem with it. If someone down in the front rows is filming a video and they've got a light on me, now I'd have a problem with that because that begins to distract from the show.
Yeah.
And another thing, I noticed a very interesting thing recently. We did some shows, acoustic shows in small venues in the USA. And we did a show in Brooklyn, and someone had taken a photograph from the side of the stage, but above, from a little balcony to one side of the stage.
Yeah.
And you could see the stage very clearly, a very nice picture of us performing, but you could also see the first four rows of the audience. And I could see half a dozen people were looking at their mobile phones. And I'm not talking about filming on their mobile phones like you were talking about. But they're doing their fucking emails or something on the mobile phone, or they're reading Twitter. And I thought, that's totally out of order. If you're gonna gig and spend your time looking at your phone, stay out. Don't kill the atmosphere by doing it in the auditorium.
Oh yeah, I mean, these days people can't concentrate on one thing. They have to like be busy, be at movies or at show, and instead of just being present on that or videoing, their minds can't consume more than one thing at a time. There has to be 500 things at the same time. Oh, that is so irritating.
People are addicted to their phones. I'm probably addicted to mine. I think everybody is addicted to the mobile phone and to the accessing of information. We're in the information age, and it just goes with the territory. But I do think people sitting in the front few rows looking at the phones, that's out of balance.
Yeah. I'm going to put you on the spot. I love this. So you must probably have already said one of the songs. Your top five, not necessarily favorites, but your top five songs by other artists.
I couldn't say definitively my top five. There's no such thing. But I can pick out five favorites for you.
Yes, please. Absolutely.
Well, one of my great favorites Just Wait to Shed a Pill by Procol Harum.
Yes.
The classic single, most magnificent record.
Yes.
And how otherworldly it must have sounded when it was released. Of course, we're all incredibly familiar with it now.
Yeah.
But at the time, in 1967, it must have sounded like a bulletin from another universe. I also very much love King Curtis's instrumental version of it. King Curtis was a great sax player. He's on many classic records. You know, he's on the old Coasters records like Yakety Yak. And he played with Aretha Franklin and Eric Clapton and John Lennon and many greats. And he made his own singles too. And he did a fantastic live version of White Shade of Pale. It's used as the opening music on the film With Neil and I.
Okay.
He's probably best known these days for that. But his version of White Shade of Pale is absolutely magnificent. So perhaps that counts as two.
Yes.
And then for a third, I'd give you Jumpin' Jack Flash by the Rolling Stones.
Okay.
Sort of where I came in, really. That was number one just when I was getting turned on to music.
Okay.
And for me, rock and roll's never got better than that. That's the summum bonum of exciting rock and roll to me. And I'll pick a few things from later years. I love Coney Island by Taylor Swift.
Okay.
On her Evermore album. It's an absolutely magnificent track. She did it with The National. Magnificent structure and very, very emotional. So I respect her very much. I love her music very much. One more. I'll pick someone from the punk rock days. God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols.
Okay.
That's an incredibly exciting way. I remember when it came out, I played it 10 times in a row, full volume, just marveling at how much power and momentum was in the grooves of the record.
Well, thank you for that. It's an interesting top five. But so when you're listening to music, first time compared to listening to the same song 10 times later, are you listening to the lyrics, the construction, the energy? What is your listening experience of when you're listening to other artists' songs?
When I listened to music as a kid, I just heard the overall atmosphere of the record.
Okay.
I didn't have any sort of discernment within it. But as soon as I became a songwriter, I began to tune in more to the quality of the lyrics and the difference between the lyric and the music and the way the lyrics served the music and vice versa. And then as soon as I became a recording artist, which would be when I was around about 20, 21, I began to notice the way that songs were recorded. And now I'm in my early 60s now. Now when I listen to a record, I hear all of that at once. I hear the atmosphere of the record.
Mm-hmm.
I hear lyrics. I hear how the lyrics interact with the rest of the record and the music of the record. I hear the music. I hear the work of the individual musicians. I hear the production. I hear the sound mix. I hear the relation of the song to the rest of the culture. I'm hearing the whole picture, really. And it's enjoyable doing that. But what I like best is when a song sweeps me up and makes me forget all of that. That's the best experience. And that Taylor Swift on Coney Island does that.
Okay.
Of course, I'm aware of what the drummer's playing and of when Taylor brings in a particular backing vocal and so on and the choices that they've made in the mix. But the emotional sweep of the song overpowers that, overrules it, and that becomes my central experience in listening. And I'm very pleased that I can still do that.
You've been recording for so long that sometimes, especially with the newer stuff, you might become cynical of the songs or what you're listening to. So the fact that you're able to let it sweep over is still amazing.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful for it anyway.
I know you come to South Africa shortly. What's your previous experience of South Africa?
But I've never been to South Africa.
Oh, haven't you? Okay, so it's going to be your first time.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Cool. So are you looking forward to that?
Very much so, yes.
Okay.
I'll be very, very intrigued. I've never been to Africa. I will never, unless it's, is it more south than Australia, New Zealand? I think maybe New Zealand is further south.
Yeah.
So I'll have been further south, but never been to Africa before. So, of course, it's very exciting indeed. I've got a South African friend called Jax Coetzer.
Yeah.
He's a visual artist who lived in Scotland for a few years, and he and I did a project together. So I'm hoping he and I are going to get together.
Between your shows, are you going to take time to tour the country?
Not tour the country, no. But we do have some time off. I think we've got a travel day between the two shows. So we'll see a bit of the place.
Yes.
I'm afraid I'm not a great tourist. I'm not so interested in going to see the tourist spots. So if you've got famous landmarks or museums, I probably won't go and visit those. But if someone tells me about a great record shop or a great bookshop, I'll go and visit those.
So the things related to your world more than the touristy things.
Yeah, well, I've never been, it's partly because of the work I do. I'm a musician and I'm conserving my energy for the show. And so traipsing around a museum or a cathedral or an art gallery, it takes my energy and leaves me like a show. And some of the band members actually like doing things like that. We had a keyboard player called Richard for many years, Richard Nafe. He's an absolutely sterling fellow. And one of his favourite things was to visit cathedrals.
Okay.
And I thought, why on earth does he visit cathedrals? Who would want to visit a cathedral? But he loved it, and it really worked for him, and it would really enhance his day. But it just doesn't work for me. I would have no interest in that.
Yeah. Well, I suppose each person has their own thing, which, you know, create the energy. Because when you guys perform, there's a lot of energy, and it's a lot of hard work. You know, the people on the receiving end of it think, it's just an hour and a half show. But the traveling, the sound check, the energy to give, you know, it's a huge amount of work on your guys' side. And I think a lot of people in the audience don't necessarily understand that, or sometimes appreciate all the energy that goes into it, all of it.
Yeah, and you see, as a performer, I want my best energy for every show.
Yeah.
I want to be peak energy when I'm on stage. So that means I have to manage my day so that all my best energy is sort of banked for the show.
Yeah,
and I often notice during the day I'm very tired. I don't have much energy. I need to have a sleep, especially as I get a little bit older. But sometimes I'm in the dressing room 20 minutes before the show and I'm yawning and I'm thinking, how can I possibly be on stage in 20 minutes? I've no energy. And then something happens about 5 minutes before the concert. It's as if someone switches a switch on my back and suddenly the energy comes on and I walk out and all the energy I haven't had during the day is suddenly available to me. It's a fantastic feeling. And so that also helps rule out any kind of sightseeing or tourist stuff.
Yeah. So we're looking forward to the show. So Mike, the podcast is listened to in South Africa, all around the world. As a final message to our listening audience, what would you like to say?
Well, you know, I hear so often these days about what terrible times we live in.
And
people are worried about the rise of authoritarianism, the attacks on women's physical rights and so on, and the attacks on democracy. And I am concerned about these things as other people are. But I also think that we've made incredible progress in the last 120, 150 years. We now, most of the people in the world have freedom of thought. We have freedom to choose religion, we have emotional freedom, and we have an incredible amount of information at our disposal. And so I think that there's that great saying about the arc of justice, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. And I would subscribe to that. We are evolving, and there are setbacks, but we keep evolving, and we ain't fucking going back.
I like that, and we dropped the mic right there.
Thank you.